Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for January 20th, 22 in the ongoing series. This is show number 3 of my discoveries. This program is going to take all year long. And these lectures right now are dealing with the what I call the pre-Cornell years. These are my years between, or during college, actually, and between my ending up in Cornell in like 1979, in the fall semester of 1979. So it's almost a 10-year period, but a lot happened then. I did a lot of traveling. I got my advanced physics degree, nuclear solid-state physics. I got my professor status by teaching at a university for 4 years in a foreign country. And I did a lot of traveling, a lot of archaeological work, and also spending time out in the wilderness, which is very important, where I did both philosophical work and physics problems, and where I developed my work on celestial mechanics, including electric and magnetic fields. So all of these things in development, and as I've said before, it's like somebody was kind of guiding me. Because when I landed at Cornell, which was possibly one of the most bizarre hirings ever in the history of university hiring, where I went in to become a graduate student and ended up being offered a teaching position. But the point is that with that teaching position, it gave me access to the data that just happened to be coming in at that time. And so here I had all my theoretical work done, all of my understanding of how electrical fields and electrical conditions worked in outer space around gravitational systems, and where everybody else had total misconceptions, because I had actually sat down and done the work and in great detail. And by the way, this is not something that just like overnight and I figured it out. No, this took months and months. And a lot of times when you're working through something like this, you make mistakes and you go, well, this doesn't seem right. And then you work farther and you come up with a lot more insight into things. And this doesn't look right over here. So you go back and you revisit some of the things you did and gain understanding. So at any rate, I want to talk tonight more about the physics and what I discovered. These are the pre-Cornell years, dealing with electric and magnetic fields mixed with gravitational fields. And in this, there's a tremendous amount of symmetry. But when you, now this is something that a lot of people don't, and it might be a little bit complicated if you're not accustomed to physics and gravitational fields. If you set up a dynamic system and everything is just sitting still, that is one situation. But as soon as everything starts to move, then all of your rotational dynamics come into play, because you have centrifugal forces, you have gravitational fields, which look very different when you start mixing in the other forces that are going on. And so anyway, I want to talk a little bit about symmetry. And I want to talk especially about symmetry in time, because we typically think of time, in fact, the good definition of time would be that this is something, an event that happens in the future, is something, it has not happened yet, but the progression of a system, whether it's a two-body physical system with gravitation or the whole universe with uncountable numbers of objects moving around, interacting, and other kinds of reactions like fusion and massive explosions going on in stars, all of this naturally occurring. And so what happened in the past, one might think, is not related to what's happening in the future. But let's take a thing, a little thing called conservation of energy. If you took the sum total of energy in, because the universe is infinite, it's very difficult to imagine the entire universe and the amount of energy in the universe, which would also be infinite, but in a sense, a fixed number. So let's take a box and let's define a region of the universe that does not have a lot of crossover. In other words, there's not a lot of galactic motion out of this box or into this box. So we take a box, and it could be just surrounding our solar system or our near group of stars, or even just the Earth or just something in a laboratory. And so what we do is look at the amount of energy in this box, which is then we can consider it, because there's not a lot of exchange going on, we can consider it a constant. So even though interactions are going on, even though the universe is progressing, or the universe in our box is progressing, etc., then the amount of energy is the same. So whether we're in the past or the present or the future, there's a symmetry in the amount of energy. Or we could talk about angular momentum or just linear momentum. And value of momentum in a system is a constant. And so in a closed system, and so the future, whether it's the future, the past, or the present, it's going to be a constant. And so in that sense, even though things change in that system and interact and change directions and have gravitational interactions or electrical interactions, etc., the total amount of momentum, whether it's linear momentum or angular momentum, etc., linear momentum, angular momentum, it's going to be a constant. So in the future and in the past, there's a symmetry. There's a symmetry between the past and the future in that those quantities are the same. So it's a point of view in the mind of a physicist what you're talking about, because most people would say, well, no, the future is not symmetrical with the past because the past is different, the paths where things came from. And we could take, for example, a comet as a great example. Because let's take an open-ended comet orbit where the comet came in. It's never been in our solar system before. It comes around the sun, and it swings around, goes out on a hyperbolic orbit, never to return again. That's not a closed orbit. It's not a repetitive orbit. It's a one-time event in our solar system. It'll never happen again because that object is moving out of our solar system, never to return again. So it's an open-ended event. But then again, if you look at the interaction of that comet with the planets, with the sun, and the gravitational fields of the solar system, for example, then the total amount of energy of the system remains constant. The total amount of momentum, whether it's angular momentum or linear momentum, it remains a constant. And so in the past and the future, those values are the same, so there is a symmetry. Now, there are other kinds of symmetry. For example, if you look at the symmetry in people, there's a bimodal symmetry that if you took a line and you stood up straight and you put your hands at your side and you drew a line physically up and down from the top of your head through your nose, down through the middle of your mouth, down through the middle of your stomach, etc., you would be symmetrical. And it's not a perfect symmetry because your left side is not going to be a perfect reflection of your right side, but they're very close. They're very close. In fact, if you took a mirror and you put it on that line and you looked, you would look pretty much the same because your right side and your left side are the same. Now, for example, my forehead, I have wrinkles. My left side of my forehead wrinkles is different from my right side of my forehead wrinkles. But those are minor details. Pretty much we're talking about symmetry, or we could talk about the symmetry of galaxies. One of the things when you're studying physics, you look for things like symmetries, asymmetries, things that have a reflective symmetry on one side versus the other. But if you take the majority of galaxies, and I've done this with my course, my DVD number 4 course, that's a downloadable course, it has lots and lots of examples of galaxies. And so the examples of galaxies are such that you can take a ruler, and you take a ruler and you put the center point of the ruler at the center point of the galaxy, and you can turn that ruler any way you want. And if you measure out a certain distance out in the galaxy in one direction, if you go exactly on the opposite side of that galaxy, the exact same distance, you will find the exact same structures, whether it's a vacant area, whether it's a cluster of stars, whether it's a bright spot, whether it's a bend in the arms, a warping of the disk. You'll find, for example, what is known as a barred galaxy, which is the galaxy actually looks like a bar, and then all of a sudden the arms swing out from there. And those are symmetrical. Now, how did the one side of the galaxy know what the other side of the galaxy was doing so that they would form it exactly the same way? And of course, there's minor variations. But in general, the amount of symmetry in a single galaxy would disprove any concept that it was formed by some kind of impulsive wave from something else passing by. You could potentially have one galaxy that might, because of its perfect alignment with an incoming object, might create some kind of symmetry in the arm pattern, given the idea that, which is incorrect, the standard science idea that galaxies' arm formations are formed by gravitational effects of passing objects. But if you look at all galaxies are symmetrical. They have, and if you find a galaxy that's warped on one side differently than on the other side of the galaxy, then you will find something over there that was causing that differential warping, something that you'll physically see something there, maybe another galaxy or a quasar or something that is warping that side of the galaxy to be different than the other. Once those arms got out there in that region, they were influenced by something else, and that something else is very visible. But aside from that, 99.9% of all galaxies are out there all by themselves, and they're highly symmetrical. And the more we look out into space, this is the thing about, for example, they just put up the James Webb Telescope, and some people are predicting that they will actually see to the edge of the universe, that beyond that point, there will be nothing. And that's what they expected previously with big telescopes. Every time they built a bigger telescope, they expected to see the edge of the universe. And every time they've been surprised, I don't know if you'd call it disappointed, but that they did not see the edge of the universe, they just found more. There was a great example with the Hubble Space Telescope. There was a region of the sky known as the Great Void, in which, with all the best telescopes up to that point, they looked into that region and they saw nothing. And so they thought, wow, there it is. That's the edge of the universe. So they took the Hubble Space Telescope and trained it on that area and looked out into that region. And what did they see? Were billions of galaxies. So there was just like a temporary void. And when they got a bigger telescope with more capability, they looked out into that region only to find a lot more of what we have around us. So there are voids in the universe. There are regions of very high concentration of galaxies. One of the biggest objects in the night sky, which I hope in your lifetime you get to see this. In other words, you get to a place that's dry enough and dark enough with nothing else in the sky, and that is our nearest neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy. And when you see it up there, it's really big. In fact, you can see one of the big features of our night sky is our own galaxy, the Milky Way Galaxy. And we live out on the edge of it. And as we look down through the rest of the galaxy, as we're on the very edge of it, but we see also the Andromeda Galaxy, and then there's another smaller companion galaxy to the Andromeda, which we can also see. It's actually bigger than the full moon. So when the full moon comes up, you go, wow, that's big. That's the biggest thing in the sky. Actually, it's not the biggest thing in the sky. The biggest thing in the sky is the Andromeda galaxy, our nearest neighbor mega galaxy, which tells us that it's very good to have that nearby because that tells us what we look like. If we were a star system in much deeper in the heart of our own galaxy, and we were surrounded by star systems and star clusters, we would probably not know much about our own galaxy. In fact, we probably would not know much about the universe in general, because when you look out, everything is so bright, it would be like having little suns in all different directions. And so the energy from those suns, the light from those suns, would be blocking your view from looking out and seeing what's beyond them. Okay, now I'm going to switch gears a little bit here, and I'm going to talk about charging in outer space. So what I was doing at this period of time in my life for these number of years, and remember that during this time also I was teaching in a university. So I was teaching physics, mathematics, computer science. And so along with my teaching, I had time to do my own research and studying the electric fields, magnetic fields, and gravitational systems. And so in understanding, for example, that only the smallest objects in outer space would be affected by charge and by electricity, by electric fields. And the reason for that, I believe I explained last week, was that the charge is not physically part of the object. When you get down to very small objects, then the charge becomes part of the object. It's just the way physical charges work. And they, for example, it has to do with the surface energy of the particles, and typically the charge that goes along with very large objects, bigger than when I say large, I'm talking about the size of, say, a basketball or larger, then you're dealing with surface charge that is not part physically of the object. So any electrical forces, etc., are dealing with the charges, but not the physical object. So there are a number of reasons besides the fact that the surface charge, as the object increases in size, the surface increases as the square of the radius, and the volume increases as the cube of the radius. So the mass is increasing, and after you get up to a certain size, when you have gazillions and gazillions of atoms there, when you get down to the atomic layer, the charges dominate. And if you have, for example, an ion, then the ionic forces, the electrical forces, dominate compared to gravity. The gravitational forces are weak. And that's what gives people the very incorrect concept that when you get up to big objects in outer space, it works the same way. And it doesn't. It does not. And I've calculated that the cutoff region is about the size of a grain of sand. And so, but then you come to the question, okay, so you have these equations, you have this understanding, but where do charges come from in outer space? Because anybody that's worth their salt in physics, the first thing they're going to encounter, if you have charges in outer space, is that space is full of charges, positive charges, negative charges, and it's called plasma. And so even though it's a rarefied medium, if you put a charge out in outer space and just all of a sudden there's a charge there, then it's going to be very quickly, other charges are going to move around it and neutralize it, and the average potential of space will remain the same. And so how do you have a charged object in space that exists for a long period of time, long enough to actually make a difference, like to build a comet? And so this was part of the, and you can see the wheels turning here. Once you got the understanding, and for example, let me just give you some basic things here, as I already was of the opinion that comets were dealing with electrical phenomena because of certain outward characteristics. The shrinking of the coma as the comet approached the sun. I talked about this, about the circle of equal force, and how when you have a gravitational set of particles, or if you have particles of the same charge type, positive, positive, or negative, negative, then the circle of equal force applies. And so, and the shrinkage of the comet Coma as it approaches the sun is an effect of the circle of equal force. So that's one indication. Then the sunward spikes, that comets indicate that they have sunward spikes, and they're very electrical. There's no question about that. Comet Aaron Rowland, 1957, was the first modern one, but they had been seen all the way throughout history. And then the green comet head, which is a very globular phenomenon visible with comets, and the fact that that shrinks as it approaches the head, and it's also a Debye shielding. So anybody that's familiar with charging objects and the shielding, which is Debye shielding, then would understand that comets exhibit that phenomenon. The tail separation, as comets move faster and faster in their orbits, the tail separates. And there's no reason for comet separation, the tail separation, in a dirty snowball comet model. It doesn't make any sense, but if the material is moving in, then the comet moves away, it breaks the electric field, and that material then goes out with the solar wind. And so anyway, all of these other items, plus the fact that solar systems are very clearly formed by capture, not by one single event where a dust cloud collapses. So all of these things indicate the phenomenon of the circle of equal force, whether it's gravitational, electrical, or otherwise. So then the question arises, if it's electrical, where does the electric field come from? How is it sustained? That's a problem, and I had to attack this problem, and eventually I understood that it was the excess current of protons in the solar wind, that the fusion of the sun was up in the upper atmosphere, that this the excess current of protons developed a nebular ion cloud at the far end of the solar system, and that this is what the discharge of the comets were, that it was acting like the backyard bug killer, so to speak, in the cosmic sense, discharging the capacitor, and that's where the current went. And it was discharging that capacitor, and as long as the capacitor was loaded, then this phenomena would keep up. And we actually saw during Hale-Bopp many years later, back in the mid-90s, that the comet Hale-Bopp actually did a fantastic job of discharging the solar capacitor. It took a lot of energy out of that solar capacitor. It's the sun, even in the year right now, 2022, the sun is still depleted of energy because of Hale-Bopp, of large comet. So anyway, eventually I had to ask the question. Before you can solve a problem, you have to define the question. You're not going to solve a problem if you don't understand the question. So it would show you that I was very far advanced in my understanding because I had the right questions formed. So when I got to Cornell and the data started pouring in, and all of this came together, my theoretical work, the data, etc., then everything started to gel. And so at any rate, what I'm trying to do is point out the timing of the discoveries and the fact that there was a point where I had to ask that question, where do the electric fields come from and how are they sustained? And so the other issue here is that the comet material would be coming into the comet nucleus. And this is in, like, if you take either the gravitational case, in which you have, say, the sun and a mass like Earth or a comet nucleus, or in that point, I was even considering, as I said before, that the comet nuclei might be something like a piece of a neutron star, because we knew they were small, you know, like maybe 10 miles across or something like that. And to get the comet effect of the tail material coming in, if it were gravitational, then that nucleus would have to be extremely massive. And the only way you could do that in a small volume as we knew comet nuclei would be to have something like a neutron star, because these tails extend out potentially a million miles. So to have a gravitational effect that large would require, and then also the combination, we know how big the sun is, to understand the size, say a 100,000 mile across comet Coma, for this to be affected by gravity, then that nucleus, which is small, 10 miles across, would have to be tremendously massive. But the same thing happens for electric fields. So if the sun had a net negative charge and the nucleus of the comet had a net negative charge, now you're dealing with the potential for much larger comet tails, etc., from electrical effects. But additionally, there were other electrical effects dealing, just looking at comet tails. So it right away started looking at the electrical side of things. And the thing that clinched it was when I was at Cornell and I was looking at the data, and the Pioneer spacecraft was going by Saturn, and it had a tremendous pull because of an unknown, previously unknown moon at Saturn. And the thing was that the electron and the magnetic sensors went off scale. So this said, okay, this is the red flag that said, okay, this could be, it threw the spacecraft off its course, and it had a very rapid acceleration. And so, but it was accompanied with the fact that the electron sensors went off scale. And still, it could have been a neutron star with a tremendously large magnetic field. So these were still possibilities, but then the idea that the force on the spacecraft was due to the electric dipole force, I actually put that in the Saturn Sweeper Moon paper, which was peer-reviewed and published in Astrophysics Journal. So anyway, you can see how these, you know, considering all of the possibilities relative to what is making these spacecraft act this way in outer space, but then leaning towards the electrical explanation because of the various effects. And then the other effect would be these, the fading of the Saturnian rings, and I talk about this in the Saturn paper, but I'm jumping ahead a little bit here to give you the conclusion that finally I came to when I finally did get to Cornell, had the data from spacecraft coming in, etc. But now, remember, I'm concentrating on the pre-Cornell years, the years where I'm formulating my theoretical work and looking at both the case of gravity. Now, gravity, if you have two objects with gravitational fields, then they combine, and then the circle of equal force and the gravitational combination of the fields in the form of the comet takes shape. And you can look in the appendices of my three-part comet paper that's printed in the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book in the appendices. And so therefore, you can see those equations at work there and what the form of the gravitational fields look like. And it also applies when you have, say, a sun with a negative charge and a comet nucleus with a negative charge. The fields look the very same because they're 1 over r squared fields. They're both attractive to positive ions and positively charged dust particles out in that region of outer space. And so the gravitational case, if the gravitational field of the comet nucleus is very large, like a neutron star, piece of a neutron star, or if it's electrical. So if you're given just that information, you would not be able to decide. But when you add in a lot of other information, like the, for example, the Debye shielding, that's the clincher. That's the one that differentiates between gravity and electrical. Because a gravitational field would not have to be Debye shielded. It would not be shielded at all. the material would simply fall in along the gravitational field lines, end of story. But now all of a sudden you have to explain this round, globular, circular Debye shielding shape that's usually typically a green color around the comet nucleus due to the hydrogen green lines and or the carbon green lines, the atomic carbon green lines, and those are ionized. And so all of a sudden you have this cloud of ionized material around the comet nucleus, and you go, that isn't the gravitational case. That is not the gravitational case. That's not explained by gravity. It is explained by the electrical case. And so you start getting to these differential factors that make a difference in which theoretical model you take. Gravity, with a neutron piece of a neutron star as the comet nucleus, or electrical, where the sun has an electrical non-uniform electric field, combining with the non-uniform electric field of the comet nucleus, both negatively charged. And then you might say, well, why are you not asking the question, could the sun be charged negatively and the comet nucleus be charged positively? And the end result is, if that were the case, then the comet tail would point towards the sun, not away from the sun. So there again, the comet tail points away from the sun. So that tells you that the polarity, the charging of the sun and the comet nucleus are the same. Either they're both positive or either they're both negative. But then again, you have the issue that if you had the positive case, sun positively charged, comet nucleus positively charged, that would give you the field line shape, but then you would have to have negative ions for the Debye shielding, and you don't have that. Also, then you would have the ions clustering around the comet nucleus with only electrons coming in to form the comet tail. So you would not have a comet tail that would be visible because electrons simply are not visible. So you can see the logical steps, process of elimination, of eliminating some of the possibilities, finally coming down to the fact that the comet structure is due to a negatively charged sun and a negatively charged comet nucleus. But then again rises the ugly little question, how are these maintained? Because in the plasma environment of outer space, charges should be neutralized very quickly. So the process would have to be a process that is maintained over a long period of time. So it's an ongoing process. How did this process work? And so that's when these are the conclusions that I had to come to. So I had to understand the solar wind, the properties of the solar wind, understand that the overall capacitor was being discharged by the comet nucleus because it's cutting the gradient of the field lines. And once this discharge starts, it always goes where the comet nucleus is. And this is similar to the backyard bug killer, where the bug flies in between the screen gratings, discharges it, and the discharge is always where the bug is. It's the same situation with comets. And so you can start to see this building of understanding, and with the negatively charged comet nucleus, the negatively charged sun, the dust and ion material, which is positively charged, comes into the region around the comet nucleus, where it then, in the situation with small comet nuclei, which have very small gravity, very low gravitational field, then this material is neutralized because there's an electron cloud there, a free electron cloud, that neutralizes the material that comes in, and that material blows out in the solar wind. And that's what fooled astronomers into believing what they called neutrals. The neutrals they thought were coming off a dirty snowball. They were getting back there with a spacecraft and measuring the neutrals. And so they thought that corresponded with the dirty snowball comet model. And everything they did, because they were assuming the Dirty Snowball Comet model, and back in those days it was still called the Iceball Comet model, they had to interpret it by that model, but then things did not make sense. Eventually, 1996, they discovered X-rays in comets, and was there ever a flurry of activity to try and keep my work out of the limelight? Very, very dedicated work to keep my work from being highlighted. And that's when they started talking about X-rays being caused by charge exchange, something that was totally bogus, never worked. And to have charge exchange, you would have to have an electric current of electrons to make it even happen. So where did the electric current come from? It's kind of like diamonds from space, which I'll be talking about in a minute here, because a great big diamond has just the other day gone on sale, a 555-carat diamond that they claim came from outer space. I wonder if they've been listening to my radio show. And anyway, of course they have, and they have to cover their tracks because of how ridiculous it is to think that diamonds come from the ground. But at any rate, I'll talk about that in a minute. So the point I'm making, however, is that in my earliest work, once I started publishing, like I said, I had a 300-page book to begin with when I was at Cornell on the structure of comets, the formation of solar system, and the prediction that there would be X-rays found to the sunward side of comets. Now, mind you, there are still many unanswered questions here. For example, if comets are becoming planets, comets are in elliptical orbits. How do they become circularized? What happens to the comet orbit so that it becomes a circle instead of an ellipse? Okay, and so those, first of all, as I said, you have to form the question before you can search out the answer. And Cornell, once again, provided those answers when I was in the stacks looking for the, following my nose, basically, came across the great and wonderful book by TJJC, The Secular Action of the Resistance Medium. And, of course, those books were around the turn of the 1900s, the century, and they were looking at the secular action of the resistant medium, which they thought caused orbits to circularize, and they had done all the mathematics and had extensive data, etc., but it turned out that there was no resisting medium. And so that concept was shelved, sidelined, discredited. And when I came along, it's what I needed to fit that other piece of the puzzle. In other words, it was the tail drag of the comet nucleus being dragged upon by this comet material coming in from the tail. So the tail is pulling as the nucleus, charged nuclear region, pulls the material in towards the comet nucleus. That then pulls back. This is Newton's law, equal and opposite reactions. And it the tail pulls against the comet nucleus and is the exact same effect as the TJJC concept of secular action of the resistance medium. But the medium is very thin, it's very vacuous in outer space, but it's being dragged in from this huge volume of space that stands outside of the comet nucleus as it discharges the solar capacitor. Now, what's amazing is that all of this information was sitting there collecting dust on the shelves of Cornell until I came along and dug it out and recognized its value and put it to good use. So, and this is the case in a lot of scientific endeavors, that the really big, smart, powerful, all-knowing NASA people who worked at Cornell, not the least of which was the world-famous Carl Sagan, never went into the stacks to look at these books. They just were sitting there collecting dust, and when I got there, they had not been checked out ever. They were not something that anybody had any interest in. And here they are, the key, the absolute key to understanding the very important part of solar system formation, which was how to get something in an elliptical orbit into a circular orbit. And of course, the TJJC work was from the early 1900s. So it had literally sat there collecting dust. But luckily, Cornell Library was a Library of Congress and had all of this material sitting there available. And so, and I also read all of the journals there and realized that they were just full of junk, full of bad science. And I was just shocked and amazed. But this is a key example of scientific discovery, of taking information that had been just sequestered or basically eliminated and finding out that it has tremendous value. It was one of those pieces of the puzzle. And these people had worked this out. TJJC and his co-author had worked this out over literally like almost 75, three quarters of a century previously. Okay, so that is very important, because when a comet comes into the solar system, it is attracting material in the tail, and that causes its orbit to change, to go from an elliptical orbit to a circular orbit. And that is the solution, by the way, that had been missing from the Velikovsky problem. When Velikovsky was talking about Venus, the comet, becoming a planet, well, it didn't make any sense, because there was no known process for taking an elliptical orbit of a comet and turning it into the circular orbit that we know Venus has today. But that's what I had discovered. And of course, by stating this, I got into big, big trouble, because what I was doing was taking NASA data coming in from spacecraft and interpreting it to basically say that everything NASA and standard astronomy and space science and astrophysics, everything that they were saying was totally incorrect, because they were using the model that this dust cloud formed the solar system all at one time, with all of the planets forming at one time. And if you look at the solar system, capture is obviously at work. Every one of the major planets, which the major planets are not planets. Jupiter and Saturn are not planets. They're small stars. And they're small infrared stars. They're very hot in the infrared with their own energy sources. Jupiter produces about two times the energy it receives from the sun, and Saturn is much hotter, producing an estimated three times the amount of energy that it receives from the sun, which to the time was the only known source of energy. Okay, so anyway, now let me go back. Remember, I'm talking about the pre-Cornell years, but I have to jump into the Cornell years, because solutions, I had the pieces of the puzzle that were sitting there, but I had to ask these questions, and these questions did not get answered until I was finally at Cornell, seeing the data, seeing these amazing works that had been bypassed in the past, etc. Okay, so right now I'm going to move to the topic of archaeology, because when I lived in Mexico, while the rest of my generation was off still battling the U.S. government over the Vietnam War and becoming hippies and living a lifestyle of you know, I don't know what, the hippie lifestyle, I guess, and basically becoming one of the lost generations, because the Vietnam War destroyed the United States, literally, inside and outside. It absolutely destroyed the country. And while that was going on, I moved to Mexico. I moved out of the country. I didn't listen to the news. I didn't partake in any of that. As far as the Vietnam War itself, when I was in college in the late 1960s, I got a conscientious objector status one of 1,200 given out since World War II as a registered conscientious objector to the war. And, of course, they wanted me to go become a medic in the war, you know, and become have some part of it. And I said, no, I want nothing to do with your wars, etc. And by the way, before that happened, as I was a freshman in college, I was up for an appointment to the Naval Academy by a Congressman Al Cui from Minnesota, because every year the congressmen get to appoint two people to each of the military academies, the Naval, the Air Force, and West Point, etc. And so anyway, I was up for an appointment, and interestingly enough, kind of a quirk of fate. I was not selected because I went to a private high school, and the kid that got the appointment from our little town, was his father was a big Republican political contributor. And so that guy's son, when I was going into freshman in college, that guy's son got the appointment to the Naval Academy. And so I did not get an appointment. And he may have gotten an appointment to the Air Force Academy. But at any rate, then the next year came around, and they told me, just wait a year and you will get it. So I got the appointment, and it was to the Naval Academy. And I said, well, I really wanted the Air Force Academy. And they said, well, don't worry about it. You go to the Naval Academy for 1 year, and then you can transfer to any of the other schools that you want, the four major military schools, meaning the Air Force Academy. And so then what I didn't know at the time was really that the top gun people, and what I wanted to do was fly jet planes. I just wanted to fly high-performance jet planes. I thought it'd be cool. And then the night before I was supposed to pack up and leave, now I'm a sophomore in college, the night before I was supposed to pack up and leave to go to the Naval Academy, I was in the school band. I was in the school jazz band. And the leader of the band came up to me and he says, hey, I heard you're leaving us. And I said, yeah, I'm going to the Naval Academy. I'm leaving tomorrow. And he goes, well, I don't know if you know what's going on, but it's a thing called the Vietnam War. And like, you know, I really didn't, because it didn't affect me. I had a college deferment. He said, well, look, you know, you're going to be, what are you going to do there? I said, I want to fly the jet planes, high-performance jet planes, because I had my physical done. I was a physics major, had perfect grades, perfect eyesight, perfect physical condition, everything, all passed all my tests for the Naval Academy to be a Top Gun pilot. That's what I was going to do. And he said, look, you're going to be dropping napalm on people over there. Do you know that? And I said, I don't know anything about this. And so anyway, he had a long conversation with me, and I'm going, holy cow, I didn't really understand this, you know. And so anyway, the next morning I thought, you know, I don't want any part of this. This is not what I'm signing up for. And so the next morning I called up the office of Al Cui, the senator from Minnesota at the time, and the secretary answered, and she goes, Mr. McCanny, well, you should be on your way to the Naval Academy today. And I said, well, I'm not going. And she goes, what do you mean you're not going? I said, well, I didn't know, all of these reasons I explained, and I said, I'm just not going. She said, well, look, nobody turns down an appointment, a senatorial appointment to the academies. Nobody does that. It's unheard of. Nobody has ever done that before. And I said, well, I'm doing it. I'm not going. And she said, okay, well, we have a long list of people waiting that will certainly take your place. And so then after that, I started to study the issues, and eventually within the next year applied and went through the whole process of becoming a conscientious objector. And I don't want to put more time in this show, but it was very difficult. And you had to go before the draft board. And they asked you questions like, well, if you were in a room, just as an example, if you were in a room with your grandmother and the bad guy came in and was going to kill your grandmother, and the only way to save your grandmother was to kill the guy, the only way to save your grandmother was to kill this guy, and that was the only possibility, would you kill the guy? They would try and trap you in these ridiculous scenarios. And there were ways to answer these questions, but it was bizarre to deal with this hometown conservative, World War II mentality, where all wars were good and all young Americans should go fight these wars to defend your country. This was the mentality, and of course, now in retrospect, even when I'm on like radio show, this is one of the more interesting things because I'm regularly on a radio show with John Moore, who's a Vietnam veteran, two tour in Vietnam, I believe, Green Beret, and even he says the Vietnam War was a sham, that it was a illegal war, that it was brought about for the profit and benefit of large corporations who were infiltrating the Southeast Asian countries for goods and profit, the CIA of the United States, and that's what they did. They were the police force of the World Bank, and I got to learn this later. I'll be talking about that in later shows, but I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but there again, I'm preparing myself mentally, physically, spiritually, and other ways to prepare for my future, where I had to become a pretty hard-nosed person when I was in Cornell, and the difficulties I had there with the astronomy department coming out to and confront me and basically destroy my future and destroy my research and prevent me from publishing work that now is clearly correct. I had to have a fairly thick skin. Okay, so anyway, this was when, in my college years, this issue with the going to the Naval Academy and then the conscientious objector status and the whole issue of the Vietnam War. And then I went on also to help other people and become a counselor to people that were trying to figure out, because the reason they take young people for the military is because they don't really have a belief system built up yet. They don't have the information because in school they've never been taught any of this stuff. I was never taught in school about the Vietnam War. It was never mentioned. It was like just assumed that government stuff over there should take care of itself. And here I am attending a four-year private all-male school Catholic university, and nobody ever talked about it. It was not, I was in ethics classes, I was in religion classes, I was in other classes that you would not experience in a regular university setting, and nobody ever mentioned it. I mean, the churches were complicit with war. Anyway, it's important to understand this, to understand the growth that I was going through at these times. So now I'm going to switch a little bit. And like I said, after I got out of college, then I went to Mexico, where I spent. Took the money that I had and I invested in a brand new Ford window van. It was an amazing brand new machine, and that is what I was able to travel in Mexico. Because in Mexico, there weren't any hotels, there weren't any accommodations where I was going out in the back country. And so this was my traveling home, so to speak. And like I say, while the rest of the United States, my generation, were becoming hippies and having the love-ins and Woodstock and other things, I was busy traveling around Mexico looking at ruins. So I'll be talking about that a little bit here. And this will lead into next week's show also. The archaeological thing was something that just was amazing. And so I'll have some stories here that I'll talk about. But these were things that were also preparing me for my future, because archaeology and astronomy eventually became buried into a subject. Interestingly enough, when I was at Cornell University, 1979 to 81, a brand new department was recognized and formed called Archaeoastronomy. And so here I am in Mexico in the early 1970s, traveling around, looking at archaeological sites, being at them as they're digging up artifacts for the first time in thousands of years, and other events, and understanding the Mayan culture, which was one that really reflected the Venus event, which was a large comet coming through the solar system. So here I am studying this firsthand. And for example, that's at that time, 1971-72 time frame, Mexico was still kind of like the old Wild West. It had not woken up. And for example, myself, being a blonde-haired, blue-eyed gringo, if you want to call it that, kind of a slang word for U.S. citizen, North American, nobody had seen people like me where I was going, into the depths of the southern jungles or up in the northern deserts or up in the region where the Toltecs lived earlier, etc. Nobody had really seen people like me. And but anyway, for example, for a Christmas vacation, because I was working teaching, I had a job teaching in Mexico, and then I also tutored the children of the very richest people there. So I lived in a very nice setting in Mexico City, and I traveled amongst the poorest people in the world, which was southern Mexico at the time. And, for example, at Christmas, where we had Christmas vacation from the school a number of weeks, I went down into Quintana Roo, which was a territory at the time. Now it's a state of Mexico. But they had just built the first road to Tulum from Merida. And what is now Cancun was not even there. There was no such thing as Cancun in 1971. And so the first day that the road opened up, and that road is still there, it's made from seashells. If you go down on the main road from Merida to Tulum today, right next to it in the jungle, you will see the old road that I went on. But I'm out of time here. This is the few minutes left here. Remember to see my webpage, jmccsci.com and jmccwaterfilters.com. You can still get 10% off from any water filter purchase using the coupon code JMCC at checkout for an extra 10% off. And I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.